Amazon 5-star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by a real serious improv podcaster. Tonight's review, Furby. I bought a Furby as a nostalgic joke. Joke's on me. Day one, adorable. Giggles, wiggles its ears, says, me love you. Day three, woke me up at 3 a.m. whispering in Furbish. I think it summoned something. Day five, I'm starting to ask it for life advice. Day seven, it blinked at me like it knew. I blinked back. We've reached an understanding. I fear it. I love it. 5 stars, Aaron M. Find your perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there. Last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
It's the most wonderful time of the year and the perfect season to treat the Formula One fan in your life. The official F1 store has everything you need to make this festive season unforgettable. From teamwear and caps to models and collectibles, you'll find exclusive F1 products and limited edition gear you won't get anywhere else. And the best part, with fast worldwide delivery, you can get your gifts on the grid just in time for Christmas, no pit stops required. Head over to f1store.formula1.com and make this festive season full of speed, style, and F1 spirit. F1 is an extreme sport in which cars race at 200 miles an hour, inches from walls and from each other. Drivers are pushed to their limits, both physically and mentally, but they're not out there alone.
Safety car, safety car. Lots of people are boxing for slicks. We are expecting more rain in 10 minutes.
I don't think slicks now.
Copy.
The voice in their ear is their race engineer, the main link between driver and team, both on track and off it. What the engineer says and when they say it is crucial.
Once a lap, you say, this is how many laps to go. I think if I'd start talking to you more than once a lap, you'd be like...
If it's critical decision to take on strategy, there are times where we must have talked like 25, 30 seconds in a lap. But you lose time doing that.
A driver's relationship with their race engineer is probably their most important in the sport. So when Laura Müller and Esteban Ocon were teaming up at Haas for the first time earlier this year, they were eager to get up to speed quickly.
Were you scared?
Yeah, because obviously we were both new, so I wasn't too sure at first. Laura, she's the most motivated that I know. You know, she's the hardest working engineer I've ever met.
Because we were all new to what we were doing, we all don't really have a preconceived idea of how it should be and just do things the way we need them to be done. So I think we molded very well together.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. A brand new role for Laura Müller and a brand new team for Esteban Ocon. 2025 has been a big learning curve for both of them. So how have they built such a strong relationship? What do they need from each other and how do they communicate both in and out of the car? Laura and Esteban share brilliant insights into their first season together. You'll hear fascinating details like when is the right time to talk on the radio and how often that changes in different situations. Laura also looks back on her journey to becoming a race engineer and the childhood hero who inspired both hers and Esteban's career. Guys, great to have you on the show. How are things?
Good so far.
So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Tell us first of all about the race driver, race engineer relationship. How would you describe it, Esteban?
Well, it's the most important part of the work, really. You know, having to have Laura as my eyes, you know, from the outside is the most important thing. You know, together, if we don't work well, we are suffering in the weekends. That's the way it goes. Unfortunately, it is. You can't drive the car nowadays alone. We were chatting about that earlier. Yeah, there's so much going on that, you know, we need to be having many brains together And if you put that in a good way, you can improve and you can build your weekends much stronger. So for me, you know, that part of the work is the most critical one, the prep before, the prep on Thursdays, the chats in between the sessions. And when we are doing, you know, a strong weekend, we can feel it, you know, all together. It's becoming, you know, one piece, and it's you know, going to plan. It's a very satisfying piece of work in between and behind the scenes.
Laura, you're his eyes and another brain on the outside of the car. How do you see what he does to help you?
You have a preconceived idea how the weekend's going to go. Like you start somewhere and you think you're going to end up at a different place with setup and all these things. But without his feedback, like when he finishes a run, you don't really know where to go, because you can look at the data, but in the end, what he feels in the car is very vital to our decision making. So without his comments, I would take much longer to make decisions.
But she would still be able to, you know. But she needs time. The time is the constraint. That's the thing.
So all the info is there in the data.
Yes.
And by speaking to Esteban, you can just speed up the process.
Yeah, basically, like you see in the data what's happening. But then, you know, I usually say to Esteban, we see this and this. Do you agree? If he says yes, you can go ahead and move on. But then if he would say, no, that's absolutely not what I feel, then it gets like complicated. But yeah, you kind of need the agreement.
We're talking at Race 21. This is the first year that you guys have worked together. How long did it take you to understand each other? How long until the telepathy between you started working?
I don't know how much telepathy you need from me, but I'd say like 3-4 races until you like broadly know what this guy needs and what he means and stuff. But I think we're still in the process of, sometimes I think you want this, but you want the exact opposite. So it just, you know, I think it never really stops.
Hang on, Laura. Can you just explain what you've just said? So he says one thing, and
can
actually...
Can you just explain that, Laura, please?
No, but like... So, you know, you have all these decisions to make and things. And like my boss asked me, oh, what do you think Esteban would want? And sometimes I'm like, I think he wants this. And then I talk to him and he says, no, I want the exact opposite. But he has a good reason for it. And I have a good reason for mine. But then, you know, I just anticipated something completely different.
What do you always say? The blanket's too short. That's your thing. Is there always a compromise somewhere?
Yes. La coperta è troppo corta.
Yes. So yes. In Italian, it's the blanket's too short. So you can't have everything you want, which is where, you know, we have to take the decision together, which is quite important.
Let's talk about your driving style, Esteban. What do you want from a race car in order to be quick?
I think the most important is to have the confidence, you know, to attack the corners, you know, strong braking, no lockups, good front end, mid corner. You know, if we have a car that's obviously, you know, good at that, you can drive it around and be fast, you know. But if the car limits you, especially on the front end side of things, which is where we struggled a bit earlier this year, that has improved massively towards the end of the year now. But we've had that, and we've, you know, struggled a bit to put the laps together at times. Once you have a car that turns well, you can perform. But there's much more into that, you know, because Laura, she has an eye also on what's overall happening in the session. And for example, you know, when it's wet, when it's starting to rain, like Silverstone, for example, you know, I'm going to tell her, if you see somebody going off, let me know. Because I know I have to attack the corners and brake at the point where it's dry. And sometimes you have no warning, you brake, you are on the dry point, but it's actually raining like 20 seconds ago, and you just go straight. But if she tells me, she sees what's happening around, she gives me the right information, then I can preempt that, stay on track, gain the positions, and not have a drama. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into it, yeah.
So the conversation, when he's out on track, how many times a lap would you be talking to Esteban?
I kind of try to limit it to once. It depends on the condition. It depends, you know, is this a race where not much happens? Is this a race where he's fighting someone? Is it wet? All these kind of things. Because normally, you know, once a lap, you say, okay, this is how many laps to go. But for example, in a quali lap, I would never dare to say anything. If not, you know, somebody's literally spinning off in front of him or there's a yellow flag. I think if I'd start talking to you more than once a lap, you'd be like,
And always on a straight, right?
Yes.
That's the hard bit, because sometimes GPS is off. Sometimes, you know, you are trying to speak in the straight, but it happens in the corners. But there are times where normal situation, once a lap, as Laura says, but if it's, you know, something critical, like brakes are, you know, over the roof, there is an issue with the engine, a critical thing, or there is, you know, a critical decision to take on strategy, you know, we agree to talk as much as we can, because that's critical for our race. So there are times where we must have talked like 25, 30 seconds in a lap. It has happened. But you lose time doing that, you know, because you are not fully focused on what you are doing in front. So you will lose 2 or 3 tenths by keeping on talking. But if you gain 10 seconds or 15 on your overall race time, or you finish a race, well, it's just a game.
Let's wind the clock back. I'm fascinated about this relationship between you two. All was new for both of you at the start of this year. New job for you, Laura, performance engineer in the past, up to race engineer this year. Brand new team for you, Esteban. Just how difficult were those opening weeks?
Well, you know what? It was not easy, for sure. There was a lot to adapt, but the transition has been incredibly smooth. And that's also thanks to, you know, Laura's work. It didn't feel like, you know, Laura was new to the role. It felt like she's done that for years, you know, already. You know, she knew exactly, you know, where to position me, where to put me, what we needed to do, what time of the work we needed to do. And arriving in the first race on the Melbourne track, which is the hardest one, on a wet weekend, there, I think, you know, even if the result was not exactly what we wanted, I think for a first weekend like that, both of us in the new role, we've done pretty well. And yeah, I mean, we've done an enormous amount of work in the winter. You know, Sasha and Laura, they came to my training camp as well. We spent a couple of days there to discuss about things, to just do like a team building you know, type of event. And we went caving, you know, managing stress, and we put ourselves in ridiculous situations in purpose, you know, to just have some genuine reaction, you know, to things. Not going to tell you exactly all
this is where, yeah, she breaks.
Yeah, but it was hard for me too, you know. It was really, really tough. But, you know, in moments where we needed to perform on different exercises, well, we could see the real us, you know, at the time. And that was really good to be able to experience that before we actually started the things for real.
Did he have you doing fitness stuff as well?
Yeah, that wasn't the problem. The caving was much more interesting.
I've never done it. It's
scary.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. If you're claustrophobic, don't do it, basically.
Yeah. How different is race engineer from performance engineer?
It's more different than I anticipated, really. Because, like, from a performance engineer perspective, you think, oh, the race engineer basically does kind of, like, supervises what I do and then, you know, deals with the driver. But the dealing with the driver part is a huge part of this whole job, because, you know, you're not a car, you're a person. So I can't just say, oh, this is the setup, you know, I have to, this is all the compromise, you have to talk about everything, you have different ideas, like a lot of work goes into it. And also the managing of people aspect, because, like, you know, okay, I do a lot of work, but, like, everybody in the factory or the aero engineers and, you know, now my performance engineer, they do all the thinking and I just take the thoughts and put it, you know, into a funnel and then we decide what we do. But all this is a lot of work, because you have to listen to everybody. You have to, you know, understand what they're thinking, ask them questions. It's just like you spend a lot of time not producing anything. And I really underestimate
managing
that.
People.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by you saying that, you know, Esteban is not a machine. He's a human being. Are we talking psychology here?
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, if you come to a weekend and you're like, you don't feel great, you're in a bad mood and stuff, of course I need to see this and I need to think about this. You know, like, I can't just be like, oh, well, he's in a bad mood, whatever. Like, some part of you also has to work on improving his mood and his outlook on the weekend.
How different are race engineers, Esteban? I mean, how different is Laura to Josh, the guy you worked with last year at Alpine?
That is interesting.
Very different. No, they are very different.
What, in how they approach the job?
Yeah, I think so. But like anyone, you know, at the end of the day, you learn with, you know, what experience you had before, and then you build yourself with also the surrounding you have. And it is very different here at Haas. You know, we have a lot more flexibility on things. You know, it's very different, the environment. And I think, yeah, Laura has a lot of say on a lot of things, basically, that's happening. And that's a very good thing, because, you know, she's very modest and she says she just picks ideas from left to right, but she has to put them together. And sometimes there's not one idea, there are 10 different ideas, you know, and you need to pick one, which is the best one. So, you know, we are very honest, you know, between us also, which is very good. You know, when I don't do the right job, you know, she's going to tell me together with Sasha. And that's also important. But when I don't think it's also right what we did, I will also say, but it's in the benefit of us all to improve for the next time. So it's difficult to compare, you know. But yes, like everybody, you know, we are all very different in the way we work. But the important is to work on, you know, the leader areas that we can always do better. At least that's my thought.
This episode is sponsored by Shopify. When you start your business, you end up wearing a lot of hats. One hour, you're the designer. The next, you're the customer service team or the accountant. And sometimes all in the same afternoon. That's why finding the right tool to make all of that easier is such a big deal. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands that are just getting started. With hundreds of ready-made templates, you can build an online store that looks like you. And its smart AI tools will help you write product descriptions, craft headlines, and even tidy up your product photos. Add on its built-in email and marketing tools, and suddenly, reaching new customers feels way less daunting. Think of Shopify as your business partner that's already an expert in everything, from managing stock and shipping worldwide to handling returns smoothly. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Turn your big business idea into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. Go to shopify.com/beyondthegrid. shopify.com/beyondthegrid. If you're someone who often ends up panic scrolling at midnight, hoping to find a gift that says thoughtful instead of I forgot, this year, give them something they'll actually love. And you can set up in minutes an Aura digital frame. You can preload it with your favorite photos, add a custom message, and it will arrive in a beautiful box so you don't even need to wrap it. As soon as they turn it on, they'll be greeted by a montage of shared memories. And what's really great is that you can keep adding to it. With the Aura app, anyone you invite can send unlimited photos or videos straight to the frame from anywhere. No memory cards, no fiddly setup, no subscription, just a smart, stylish frame designed to bring people closer together. Whether it's a silly selfie, a birthday snap you nearly forgot to send, or a moment you want to share with someone miles away, it shows up on the frame just like that. I've got one ready to give my family at Christmas, and I'm already planning to sneak in a few paddock photos next season. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver matte frames, named number one by Wirecutter, by using the promo code GRID at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code GRID. This deal is exclusive to listeners and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get it in time for the holidays. And support our show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Does it help, Esteban, if a race engineer has raced themselves? Does that help them get into your mindset?
Not necessarily, no. No, I think the most important thing is, you know, how motivated and how hungry, you know, the people around you are. And Laura, she's one of the person that are the most motivated that I know. You know, she's the hardest working engineer I've ever met. You know, she doesn't count hours. She will be flat out until she has the point. Until she proves the point, until she knows that's correct. But in the meantime, you know, when we don't do something correct, she will reset and try and do it differently for the next time. But if you had a race engineer that had raced, sometimes he will try and do the racing driver job, which is not, you know, everybody needs to be at his place, you know, which is quite important.
Yeah, so, I think you'd have competing thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So no, I don't think so.
So Laura, do you just want information from him, or do you want him to catch, or do you want him to suggest solutions as well? Or is that your job?
That is my job. It's not like he doesn't like to sometimes suggest solutions, but like in a perfect world, you know, he just has to provide the information and I find the solution. But also it helps, like, if then I have a solution and I present it to him, then he has an idea if this is what he wants or not. We're not that independent from each other. We need to talk to each other all the time. It's just a revolving conversation.
I suppose I should ask, have you raced?
No.
Did you ever want to?
As a child, yes. But as a child, your push behind an idea is not that great if your parents aren't into that. But I don't regret not having raced. Sometimes I would like to just do a lap somewhere just to feel all these things he's always telling me. But
I need to take you around the lap. That would be nice in the car.
I can feel a Pirelli hot lap coming on.
Yeah, that would be awesome, actually.
Actually, I would love that.
Yeah, yeah.
Not just to learn, but just to experience.
It's actually
it.
Crazy we haven't done that yet. Like, we are so, like, head down into the work, and yeah, we need to make that happen, definitely.
Laura, you used to work for a GT3 team based at the Nürburgring.
Mm-hmm.
There were no laps of the Nordschleife after work?
No, because I have a very modest car, or I used to. And
that's even more fun.
Yes, but if you destroy that car, you don't have a car anymore.
That's very true.
And also, I don't think if you know, but if you destroy like the barrier at the Nordschleife, you have to pay per meter and it gets very expensive.
Well, just so, don't crash.
But I've done laps in the passenger seat in the wet in a Porsche GT2. And
that's not fun.
Oh my God, I thought I'm going to die.
Yes, that's not fun.
Laura, why motorsport for you? Just tell us a little bit about your journey. Listeners and viewers of the show know about Esteban's.
We have the same childhood hero, do we?
Michael Schumacher. Really? Aww.
Yes.
It's wholesome.
Was it Michael Schumacher that brought you in?
Yeah, because, you know, I'm German. You watch F1 in Germany as a child, and Schumacher won 7 world titles, so you see him all the time, you see him dominate. And, you know, on television, I mean, I've never actually met him, but on television, he seemed like this wholesome, really great guy. So as a child, you're just like, oh, this guy is great. So, yeah. And I don't know, my mum used to watch a lot of motorsports. So I watched F1 every week.
So the attraction was motorsport first, then engineering second, or did they come together?
Definitely motorsport first, because like until you actually enter motorsport, I don't think a lot of people have a lot of ideas what people actually do here, because from the outside, if you don't like look into it so much, if you don't listen to podcasts and all these things, it's just the idea is interesting. But then like after school, I was like, how do I get into motorsport? And then I realized, okay, I should, you know, either become an engineer or a mechanic or all these things. So that's, you know, how the detail formed of it.
Esteban told a great story last time he was on the show about being at the French Grand Prix at Manicourt. I think you said 2006, dressed, I think, head to toe.
Yeah.
In Michael Schumacher.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Awesome. Getting booed by Fernando's yes. fans back then.
Did you ever go to Hockenheim and watch Michael or any other race?
I think, I don't know which year it was. I think it was 2004, Nürburgring. I think Michael actually won that race. And yes, I went to that, but I went because I knew somebody who drove Porsche Super Cup and I was too young to go into the pit lane, which was very sad. But yes, I went to, I think, 2 F1 races in my life before I entered it as a job.
And then as a job, it was sports cars, wasn't it? And GT3. And
yes.
What was it like going to Le Mans? Tell me about those long distance races and how different it is from a work point of view to what you're doing now.
So I still very much love endurance racing. Like,
so you're saying that's easy now, what we do.
No, it's a very different difficulty in a way. It's obviously you have very different focus, but I still love watching them now. Obviously, like a 24-hour race, you have to stay up 24 hours. That's difficulty number one. And then, you know, you have to set up a car for 3 different compounds for wet, dry, dark, light, all these things for 3 different drivers. So I didn't enjoy that very much, but also because not so much anymore or in the top categories, but if you make a mistake or if something bad happens at the beginning of a 24-hour race, you can fix it. You can come back from it. Whereas here, you know, at the start, if you lose 3 positions, your race can be over. So I enjoy the fact that you can come back from somewhere.
How different is a sports car to set up to a Formula One car? Is it more basic? Do you have more or less tools for you to use on a sports car?
I think from a suspension point of view, they're actually very similar. It's not as like complicated because the packaging doesn't need to be so small and all these things, but like from, you know, which things you can adjust, it's very similar. But then obviously, of course, the aero, because like all the cars are the same and all these things, you have much less tools to work with. And then also you can't change anything. The good thing about Formula One is if you, after one race, you say, oh, I think we should change this part, you can actually just talk to the designers and it will happen. So That's the enjoyable part about F1, that it's not a one-make series and you have a huge impact on the car next year, the car in 3 races and all these things.
Describe the sense of anticipation when a new part is coming to the car. And I'm thinking most recently in Austin, right? We had the upgrade there. Just describe what it was like during the build-up and how you guys got on top of it.
I like that you describe it as a birthday present, basically. I wouldn't say I get excited about it because I'm very like realistic. And, you know, they will make a presentation and they will tell you, oh, we think it gains 2 points here, 3 points there and stuff. So I usually, you know, think about the worst I can expect because
she only believes it when she sees the performance gain on track, basically.
which isn't, I don't, it's not because I don't trust, you know, the designers and all this stuff. It's just like, I really hate being disappointed. So I always like go in with a slightly underestimation just to be sure that I don't stand there and I'm like, oh great, this sucks. I think this year, because the car was good this year, the whole year, you know, we weren't nowhere with the car, so the anticipation I think for an upgrade is less because, you know, it's going to improve, but where we are right now is actually okay. Whereas in years, you know, where you've struggled and you're P20 the whole year, if you get an upgrade, you're like clinging onto it thinking this is going to change your trajectory, basically.
Hang on, guys, I know you say I know you say the car's been good all year, but I want to take you back to Melbourne, all right? You
two, please start.
No, you forgot something there, all right?
You two have only been working together for a month or two at the time. You're still getting to know each other. You're still getting to know the car. How tough was it to go to Melbourne? And I'm going to use the word struggle. It was a struggle, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was so long ago that we forgot it.
That's a good thing about F1. There's a race every week.
Yes.
But guys, what happened in the immediate aftermath of Melbourne?
It was a reality shock, I think, for us all. After the first run, I remember thinking, yeah, that lap wasn't too bad. Where are we? Well, we are
P25.
Yeah, we are basically last. Okay, that's very strange. And the car was doing very weird things in a way that we were not expecting. And yeah, at the time, I mean, I didn't say it to anyone. I kept it for myself, but I thought, shit, that's going to be a very long year. Laura probably thought the same, but we didn't, you know, say that to each other because, you know, we need to be at it. We need to improve the situation. We need to do everything we can to make that car work. So when we traveled to China, we had very little hopes, but that's still, yeah, my best result of the year.
That's the checkered flag, mate. P7, P7.
Good job, guys. Super happy for you guys.
Yeah, man, what a turnaround.
What did you change for China?
Well, we changed quite a lot, actually, of actual parts on the car. That was one big thing. We didn't change fundamentally, you know, a lot of things in terms of setup, but we kept digging. And we improved massively our performance. And the car felt actually very good in China in comparison to how it was in Melbourne. So,
and Laura, from an engineer's point of view, when you've had a really tough moment like you did in Melbourne, Esteban talks about digging. You did some digging. Where do you look?
Our job is to describe what the problem is, to point out where the problem arises, how it, you know, affects him and all these things. And we just give that feedback to the design office and to the aerodynamicist and all this stuff. And then, you know, they dig on their side where it comes from. So we look on the surface where the areas is where we're struggling, but they look at, you know, the parts where it actually comes from. But from a setup point, of course, you know, if you start the weekend with a car and you're terrible, you're obviously trying to salvage everything you can with setup. So yeah, in Melbourne, we spent all night just trying to solve the situation.
If you took the car back to Melbourne now, how much better would it be?
Well, we will see next year.
Very different, sadly. It would be interesting.
You can't go back to a track and say, yeah, everything will be fine, but it will be much better. It would be much better. I'm not going to say we will, you know, finish fifth and fight with McLarens and Red Bulls. But yeah, we've come a long way since then. A lot of understanding. The cars dramatically change. I think the aero consistency across parts and how, you know, we've seen things this year and the amount of learning we've had. Yeah, it would be a very different race weekend for sure.
How different are racing drivers, Laura? You've worked with a few over the years at Haas. I think Kevin Magnussen was the guy you worked with most as a performance engineer. And then I think at Le Mans, tell me if I'm wrong, Juan Pablo Montoya?
He was on my team, but he wasn't on my car.
He wasn't, okay. But how different are drivers? And are Formula One drivers just a cut above?
I had that question before, so your turn.
So, as Esteban said about race engineers, people are very different. So also, I don't think I've ever met two racing drivers who reminded me of another one. They're all very different. And I think because, you know, the bringing up the pressure and all this stuff, you become a very distinctive personality, which is, I think, the same for engineers in F1, really. I wouldn't really say that F1 drivers are a cut above. Sorry.
What does that mean?
Like, I don't think F1 drivers are so much better than drivers in endurance racing and stuff like this. It's just they were at the right place at the right time.
Oh, thank you.
No, but like, I think if you would have had one different turn in your life, you would have ended up somewhere else. And I think it's the same for a lot of drivers who drive endurance racing now. And also there was drivers who were in F1 who then, you know, had a few bad races and then they're gone forever. So I think, you know, like any racing driver who competes in a factory competitive world championship is an extremely good driver. So I wouldn't make a difference there, to be honest.
Laura's definitely a realist.
I have to
show her I'm better than the endurance drivers. But,
Laura, where are the good ones better? Is it all about feel? Is it about feedback?
Be nice.
I've never managed that. I think there's two different best or good. So either you have a driver who's very talented and has a very good feel and can just very well explain to you what's happening in the car to help you make a decision. Or you have a driver who is talented enough but also works very hard, also knows the car and how, you know, what you can change on the car. And that driver will describe to you what's happening, but also then have some suggestions in which direction you can go. But for me, the best driver is obviously fast, but also has very good feedback. Because without feedback, like we can't get anywhere.
How much sim work do you guys do as part of your preparation? How key is that?
I don't know if people know this, but Haas, we don't have our own simulator in the factory. So we have a cooperation with Ferrari on this. So first of all, we have to go to Italy to go to the simulator. And as, you know, the trackside engineering team, we do all the races. So basically, I don't go to the simulator. We have like
You've been actually this year.
Yes, but I don't go to all the sessions just because it's just too much. I wouldn't be able to do the actual race event preparation then.
So what engineering team do you have around you when you're in Maranello?
So I have the engineering team, you know, one person works at Haas. He's called Maurizio Bocchi. He's working there, you know, for our team. And we have the engineers of Ferrari that are basically managing the team. But Laura works with Maurizio at the team in Italy to basically send all the test items that she needs before, you know, we get to the track in FP1. So basically she will have a detailed report on every run that I will send her after the simulator day, because she's prepped all the run plan, and then she will know what's the best setup item that we should try or that we should use for the race weekend.
Is it one sim day per race?
Pretty much, yeah. Except the triples or the doubles. Like we basically can't come back in between. I've done that in the past, but it's just too much because you need to recover after a race weekend. Or when you are, you know, in this part of the world, you can't really come back to Italy in between. So yeah, it's usually one sim day before every race and after every race.
Can you join them virtually?
We're trying that, but like obviously, like, you know, on Teams or whatever, I'm there. But like we have a very specific setup, so at the moment it's not really possible. But like as Esteban kind of described, I run a very tight ship of what's been done, so I don't need to put a lot of input into it during the day.
Can you give me some examples? So we're going to Interlagos. We're going to try what? I want to try this rear suspension. I want to try this front suspension, this ride height. And then you put those into the sim and report back what works best?
Basically, yeah. What's quicker? Yeah. What's quicker? What feels the best? The simulator is always difficult to tell, you know, some stuff. You need to be aware that the simulator will have some limitations compared to the track. But the more you go, the more you find out this, basically. But it's very good practice for us all. It's also something that, you know, we've tested, so we gave it our best. There's no regrets, you know, once you get to the track. And yeah, I mean, I will have a first feel of what this change could do, basically.
And what's the correlation like between the sim and what you're feeling out on track?
Well, the more we go, the better it is, normally. So the more both drivers have inputs post-races, is the better. The problem recently with, you know, how it is in F1 is that you can't correlate a triple header plus prepare a double or a triple. Unfortunately, you don't have enough time, so you will privilege your prep for the next weekend instead of developing your previous weekend to help next year. You know, so you do some correlation, but not the whole thing.
And Laura, for you, having Io as team principal, but massive engineering brain in there, has he been a support to you,
like in my life, in my job? no
all of the above, I don't know.
Yeah, but of course, like at the beginning of the year, when I had like a race engineering question, he would be the person to go to, because my boss was also new to the team. So, you know, he was learning how we work, how modern F1 works, all these things. So, you know, I could ask him for broad advice, but like if I needed something specific, yeah, I was the person I went to.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. As your business grows, security and compliance have a way of getting complicated pretty quickly. But when customers are trusting you with their data, putting things off until later doesn't really cut it. But it doesn't need to be complicated, not if you have Vanta on your side. Vanta is like your always-on AI-powered security expert. It automates your compliance tasks, keeps tabs on your controls with continuous monitoring, and brings everything into one place so you're not left scrambling when questions come up. Whether you're a fast-moving startup like Cursor or a larger company like Snowflake, Vanta scales with you and fits into your existing workflows so you can keep growing a company your customers can trust. Get started at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid. One of the things I love most about Formula One is how its past is always present. From iconic liveries to legendary rivalries, history isn't just something we look back on. It's what gives the sport its soul. And that's why I'm so pleased to be partnering with Honda Vintage Culture for this episode, because that same spirit is stitched into every piece of their clothing collection. For more than 75 years, Honda has helped shape motorsport as an engine supplier, a technology pioneer, and the force behind some of F1's most unforgettable eras. From their first Grand Prix win in 1965, to powering teams to multiple world championships in the late 80s and early 90s. Some of you might remember that unlike the race teams in those eras, Honda engineers and technicians often wore their own distinct uniforms, and Honda Vintage Culture brings those looks back to life. These aren't just retro pieces, they're heritage garments. Jackets, tees, hoodies and caps, reimagined with modern cuts, materials and detailing built for everyday wear. The officially licensed collection draws inspiration from key breakthroughs and championship-winning moments where Honda left its mark on the sport forever. With Honda set to return to Formula One in 2026 as the works power unit supplier for Aston Martin, now feels like the perfect time to celebrate that legacy and wear a piece of it. And with worldwide shipping available, it's easier than ever to do just that. Right now, listeners can get 20% off the full Honda Vintage Culture range. Just head to hondavintageculture.com and use the code BTG20 at checkout. That's 20% off with the code BTG20 at hondavintageculture.com. And so, guys, in conclusion, what's the biggest thing you've learned together this year?
It's a very weighted question. I think for me, it's like, first of all, to never give up, which sounds very like boring, but it's like it has like different aspects for me. It's like to basically not lose faith. It, you know, if it's going badly for one weekend, you know, you always have to reset yourself and just say, okay, I'm learning this. And next weekend, you know, it's going to be different and we're going to improve this. And also during a weekend, if some, you know, if qualifying went badly, often you still have a lot to play for in the race. And I think that's also something you're good at. Like, you'll be pissed off for a minute, but like, as soon as the next day comes, you just sit there and you're like, okay, now I worry about today and I don't worry so much anymore about yesterday.
I've heard other people say that about Esteban, resetting.
You're quite good at that.
Thank you. I'm good at resetting. I have bad memory, so I forget.
But for you, what's the biggest thing?
But you know what? That's something I found actually, you know, awesome, is that we are very similar in the way we work and the way we think about things. Is that I was going to say exactly the same. So it sounds boring, but, you know, never giving up, you know, keeping on digging, keeping on being motivated for what's coming ahead, because there can be an opportunity even if things don't go to plan. And we've shown that this year. We didn't have, you know, the best Saturdays at time, but on Sundays we've came back and we've rise the whole weekend, and we, you know, made ourselves forget, you know, the beginning of the weekend. We didn't forget it because we've put it on the side to try and see what we could have done better there. But by resetting and focusing on the actual moment, we've saved the weekend, the score points. And Ayao told me, you know, you will work with Laura next year because you guys are very similar in the way you're working and how hard, you know, you are working. And I was like, yeah, okay, we'll see. That's cool. But I've never found, you know, an engineer that was, you know, so hard onto things to, you know, prove the point, find the point, and get the best out of things. So,
Esteban, how did you feel when Ayo said you were going to be working with Laura from the point of view of she was new to race engineering?
Yeah.
Were you scared?
Yeah, because obviously we were both new, so I wasn't, you know, too sure at first. Yeah, it was quite a lot of unknowns, because obviously if you have an engineer that's been settled, has worked, you know, the whole year in the race engineering job, it's just one side that needs to adapt to it. Now, you know, everything is new on our side of the garage. But I really think like we've adapted so well to the situation and so quickly. Roa said 3-4 races. And to be honest, I wasn't even going to say less. I think we got little details further into the year that we always improve, but I think every engineer does that. But yeah, I think from race one, with the amount of work that we've done before, we were set and ready to race and to fight.
Maybe both being new helped.
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty sure in hindsight. Definitely.
I think it's always... So, because our performance engineer was also new.
Yes.
So it was just like full new. But I always think if somebody is new, the less experienced they are, the more you can mold them to what you need. And I think because we were all new to what we were doing, we kind of molded very well together and just do things the way we need them to be done. Because like we all don't really have a preconceived idea of how it should be. So I think, you know, we've taken the positive from that.
And how important was this year ahead of the rule changes next year? You wouldn't have wanted to be in the situation you were in January this year, next January, right?
Oh, that would have been extremely difficult. So, I mean, it's not a practice year. Let's not call it like that, because it's extremely important for us to build. But yeah, I think it would have been much tougher to start with everything new and people learning around us as well, and not knowing what we would face. I think it has been very good to actually start now, you know, into the last year of that regulation. It's been strong, and I'm happy with what we've done.
Yeah, because what wasn't new was the car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
How cool are you on the pit wall, Laura? I wanted to ask you about Miami.
You're cool.
I mean, come on, I'm pretty cool. Oh, the famous Miami thing.
Well, he's busy going around the outside of Lewis Hamilton, right?
He wants that inside line. Ocon's not going to give it to him. So can he get around the outside and keep a wheel on the racetrack? We go side by side. Is there enough room through 12 and 11? What an overtaking spectacle we've had. And that door was always going to close. That's Esteban Ocon's
engineer.
That's a
peak reaction as well there. The wins. We've all done it.
Laura Müller looking on.
What are you thinking at that moment?
Well, to be honest, like in that moment, I was just like a fan watching a battle. Like that's, you know, everybody's seen that video of me making faces and stuff. But like in that moment, I can't help him. He needs to do his thing. So, you know, there's not something I can look for or whatever. So I was just watching, you know, your onboards and being like, come on, come on. And that's like, for me, if I, you know, a race start, for example, is the same. Like in the first three corners, I can't do anything. So all I'm looking at is just, you know, the onboard and hoping he's going to make enough positions.
But it must be so satisfying when like it goes well, like because the amount of work we've put in during the weekend and we see that it's worth it, you know?
Yeah, like definitely. Like I have that feeling more in qualifying usually.
Okay.
Like when we qualify well and I'm just like, yes.
Is it relief or it's
no, because like, you know, like for me, all I do, like, you know, kind of the peak of everything is qualifying. Yeah. Because the race, I can't change the car anymore. So the strategy kind of takes over. So yeah, for me, if I've done my job well, we qualify well. So yeah, the relief is in qualifying.
Does that not apply for the driver as well though? In that, you know, speed, it's all about one lap on a Saturday, whereas Sunday there is tire wear and traffic and all the other things affecting.
There's no points on Saturday though.
Yes,
but yeah, it is extremely important. It makes your life much easier for Sunday, but I would disagree a bit with you on Sunday, because it's also the work that we've done on Saturday that's going to transfer to Sunday, because there's a lot of thoughts that goes into Sunday as well.
But it's very different thoughts.
Yes.
You know, like, because obviously I was a performance engineer for a long time. For me, like, the heart and soul of what I like doing is still, like, the car setup.
Yeah. She's frustrated basically on Saturday night when we can't change anything anymore.
Like, oh, that's boring now.
Yes, exactly. Can I go home now?
You've talked about the sort of hard work that's gone in. For people at home, just can you give us some ideas on a Grand Prix weekend? How long are the days? And also, how does a sprint weekend change the intensity?
Well, you've been here for 11 hours now. basically.
Yeah, I left the hotel at 5:30 this morning.
Well, it's 4:40. She still has 2 hours of work later. Thank you, Tom.
Laura, jet lag? Or why are you leaving? We're doing this on a Thursday. Why 5:30 on a Thursday?
Okay, there's curfews. So to basically mostly protect the mechanics, really, there's curfews in place. So on Wednesday night, they start. So on Wednesday night, at a certain time, the mechanics and everybody else has to leave the track. Obviously, like, you know, the mechanics can't take the car home, but we can take our thoughts home. So for us, that doesn't fully apply. But then on Thursday morning, this morning at 6 o'clock, we were allowed in the track. So if you want to maximize your working time, you're here at 6 o'clock. But yeah, I can tell you exactly how many hours it is. So on a Thursday and Friday, it's usually 13 and a half hours. On Saturday, it's 13. And on a Sunday, it's 12. Because I do my timesheet every month.
And how much does the intensity increase on a sprint weekend?
It's very different, of course, because, you know, you have this from Friday to Saturday. You can't change anything. But then because between the sprint race and qualifying, the time, it feels like it's 20 minutes. Like, you have to prepare everything still before Saturday morning, but you don't know how the car is going to be in the sprint race. So sometimes you spend all this time on Friday night, like thinking, oh yeah, this is what we're going to do tomorrow. And then in the sprint race, everything just gets turned upside down. So you do the exact same amount of work again after the sprint race.
But in a very short period of time.
Obviously, because you don't have three practice sessions, you do less changes, of course, but you have to think more because you have less chances of making it right.
Just from a sporting point of view, do you guys like the way Parc Fermé opens up after the sprint?
I think it's extremely difficult for all of us because there's a lot of uncertainty into a sprint weekend. For example, if there's an issue in FP1, you go into the qualifying blind, you haven't tested anything, you are not sure. Basically every run counts because also your tire choice in FP1 can dictate if you are going to have, you know, a good strategy later in the sprint race or later in the race as well. And if you don't make every session count, well, you are going to have a problem somewhere and that's going to be detrimental to your weekend. So unfortunately, we work with a lot less information and confirmation. So there's a lot of guessing and pre-event work and work from the years before. But that's also, you know, how I got the podium last year, for example, because with the resurfacing, people didn't know that the Inters were actually lasting the whole race and they boxed. And, you know, it also brings opportunity and uncertainty.
Yeah, and it's an opportunity for some and sadness for others. But I enjoy sprint weekends just because, you know, you have to, if you get it right to begin with, you have a really good chance. And because they open Parc Fermé now, at least if you didn't get it right for the sprint race, at least you have another chance on it. But I like that there's two qualifyings because it's just a bit more interesting.
Well, we know how much you like qualifying.
Exactly. I actually like qualifying that much.
It was made for you, Laura, the sprint format. Oh, guys, it's been a wonderful chat. I can see that you two have a very special working relationship, actually. It's been great to witness it a bit. If I can just end this what I call the traditional way, Formula One is 75 years old this year. I've actually asked Esteban this question already this year, earlier on. So, Laura, if there's one memory in F1's 75-year history that stands out to you, what would that be?
I think you overestimate how much I know about F1.
It can be one of yours also.
Okay.
Your memory.
Kevin's pole, 2022.
Okay, Kev.
What position are we?
You're P1, mate.
You're kidding. You're kidding me. I've never, ever felt like this in my life.
And Kevin Magnussen will be on pole position for the sprint race here at Interlagos.
It was my second race as a performance engineer. And we were joking in the morning in the car, because back then it was like the sprint weekend where you had FP1 and then it was done. And we were joking about how much I worked on the setup. And I was like, I did my best. And then my race engineer was like, yeah, but is it good enough for pole? And I said I did my best. You know, it's still a Haas. And then he joked and he said, if we get on pole today, you're all invited to Fuga de Chao. And of course, nobody expected it to happen. So then when it actually happened, my first thing was like, excuse me, you know what's going to happen now.
And did you go?
Yes, the next year we went. But yeah, that was amazing. Oh. Just like, yeah, because it's a very emotional sport. And even though, you know, it was not because the setup was good, it was just right place, right time. But it's just like in that moment, you're just like so ecstatic about
the
such
setup
a good
was good
result.
Also.
It couldn't have been terrible, but you know, like there was a lot of reasons why he got
of course goal. Yes.
He
take
just,
some credit, Laura.
He just
also.
Drove a mega lap, but this pole position made the whole year better because 2022 was hard.
Guys, thank you very much. I know you've got 2 hours work still to do, so I feel you better get back to it. Thank you both very, very much for your time.
Thank you.
Who can forget K-Mag's pole at Interlagos in 2022? A brilliant moment for the team and for Laura in only her second race as a performance engineer. Well, I loved this chat with Laura and Esteban. I hope you did too. I learned a lot about how they work together, how they rely on each other, and how well they get on. Guys, thank you very much for your time. And I hope you get that Pirelli hot lap sorted. Well, that's almost it for this episode. Before I go, don't forget to check out F1 Nation's review of last weekend's Qatar Grand Prix. Jolyon Palmer and Paul Aron join me to discuss how Max Verstappen capitalised on McLaren's strategy error to ensure the championship fight goes down to the final race. That's out now, and on Thursday, we'll preview that unmissable three-way title showdown at the season finale in Abu Dhabi this weekend. Make sure you follow F1 Nation on your podcast app so you can hear that as soon as it's available. Thank you very much for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another big name from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Having MG can make cooking difficult, but over the years, I've found some really helpful tools and tips that I'm excited to share. Hi, I'm Alicia. I think cooking should always be fun, creative, and of course, delicious. These black bean burgers are hearty, full of flavor, and MG friendly. You're gonna love them.
Check out Alicia's Black Bean Burger cooking video and other recipes full of tips and tricks for managing common MG symptoms while cooking only at mg-united.com.
Ready? Let's cook.
Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.